My name is Paul Hain, and this session is titled Materialistic Culture? And it's part two in a four-part series, which is trying to get you to think about moral criticisms of our economic life. And I'm not covering the whole area, obviously. I'm focusing on American life, which is very provincial of me, but it helps sometimes to take a little picture and look at that. I want to begin by reviewing what I meant to say last time that mattered. I meant to say a lot of things. Some of it mattered less than others of it, I think. But the most important thesis that I was trying to push last time, and I haven't changed my mind in the 24 hours since, is simply this. That it's a fact, I'm asserting, that one cannot live in a large, impersonal society, which is, means a modern society, and act toward everyone in accordance with the ethical principles of the face-to-face society. At least one cannot do that without causing the society to break down, without creating chaos and injustice and just a general mess. What I mean by acting in accordance with the ethical principles of a face-to-face society means distributing responsibilities and rewards to others, first of all, by setting their own interest ahead of one's own, and then doing things, allocating duties and privileges among others on the basis of need and merit. Now, I'm asserting that you can't do that in an impersonal society. And in order to illustrate, let me take what I think is a relatively neutral example. I like the example of traffic. Suppose that when you were out driving, you decided to do this. You come to an intersection, say it's a four-way stop, and you decide, I am now going to let others go, or I myself will go on the basis of need and merit. Hopeless. Now, have you ever been in a situation, say, where people are coming out of a crowded parking lot after an athletic contest, and there are two lanes of traffic merging, and it's obvious we quickly catch on, we obey the rules of the game, the rules of the impersonal society, which say you take turns. First this lane, then this lane, you know what I'm talking about? You're merging into a line of traffic. It's one car, then the other car, one car, then the other car. And you notice that's totally without regard to the fact that this is a doctor who has a patient who badly needs an appendectomy. And this is just some goof-off who intends to drive around the block before going home. You take your turn without regard to need or merit. And that works. And you know, and the interesting thing is this, if you say, I am going to be selfless and let all of those people go, you quickly get a signal that you are behaving unjustly from the people behind you. Because what you're doing is you think you're being generous, and you are. But you are being generous largely at the expense of those people behind you who did not consent for you to be generous. Now, this is a simple little example, but it illustrates the kind of bind that we get into when we suppose that we can behave in a large impersonal society by the rules that we recognize to be appropriate to a face-to-face society. Again, to check this out for yourself, and don't think of obviously inconsiderate and nasty behavior, compare the rules of traffic when you're in your car and you can't have a face-to-face eye-vow relationship with other drivers with the rules of traffic when you're in the grocery store, where you do indeed hold doors open for people, help somebody by carrying out their groceries. Really, you pay attention to particular needs and merit. You say to a person, you're in a hurry and you only have two items, go ahead of me. That's fine, that works fine. But it cannot work if you try to organize an impersonal society on that basis. Now, what it's going to do is it's going to slow down the traffic, it's going to increase the accident rate, and it's going to create manifest injustice. Now, the best driver, and I'm just taking traffic again as an illustration. I want to stay away from the kinds of things that we suspect are tinged with evil. Of course, I think traffic is tinged with evil. this is irrelevant, but I happen to share the view of Ezra Machand, who thinks that the invention of the automobile Well, he used to argue that the invention of the automobile was the worst disaster to befall the human race in the 20th century. And he changed his mind, and I agree with him both originally and when he changed his mind. He now thinks it's the worst disaster to have befallen the human race in its history. And one of the reasons for that is I think that it has vastly extended the area of the impersonal in areas where it ought not to be extended. The automobile has done much to make our neighborhoods not neighborhoods at all, but almost entirely places for impersonal relations. Not because it ought to be so, but because once you live out of your automobile, it is almost impossible to run a community. It isn't even a community, to run a city in any other way. People don't know their neighbors. They don't meet them. We don't walk. But that's not totally irrelevant, but it's largely irrelevant. What I really want to say is that the rules of the impersonal society are quite simple. They are pursue your own interest following the generally accepted rules of the game. And I submit, I believe that the more you think about it, the more carefully you think about it, the more you will realize this is the way we behave and it works quite well. This is what enables us to cooperate. That's certainly what makes the traffic move during the rush hour. People are obeying the generally accepted rules of the game and assiduously pursuing their self-interest. Thou shalt not get too concerned about the interests of other drivers. If you do, you're going to cause an accident. To love your neighbor in this way, now that's enough for the summary. I get on with the next problem. To love your neighbor in this way is obviously unsatisfactory to a lot of us. We all feel it. I feel it. It's somehow the idea that I can behave responsibly and morally by pursuing my own interest and letting the public interest somehow emerge as by an invisible hand out of that is not very satisfactory to us. We have all been reared to believe that the only values that count and the only ethical rules that ought to pertain in human society are the ethical rules of the family, of the face-to-face society, where we do things on the basis of ability and need and merit. We believe that it is only good, that social behavior toward others is only good when it is done intending good for particular others. You know, if you do good accidentally, that's not really good. You've got to mean to do good for some particular person. That is really moral. And when most of the good that you do is the unintended and unknown byproduct accruing to unknown others of action that you undertake in your own interest, well, if you're like most of us, you feel morally uncomfortable with that. Now, that's the dilemma that I'm trying to get you to think about. And I suggested that I do believe that we have trapped ourselves into this dilemma. And one part of the trap, which I suggested last time, was that we don't recognize the real legitimacy of the ethics of the impersonal society. I submit that it is moral in an impersonal society to pursue your own interest, obeying the generally accepted rules of the game. I suggested that this is the idea that Augustine had in talking about the way in which the city of man was governed and the way in which something that Luther had in mind when he talked about the two kingdoms, or what theologians for centuries have meant by the orders of creation, these structures that God has given us, though they may be fallen indeed, but nonetheless which sustain order and cooperation and make human societies possible. And I think we must learn to live in them without guilt, because guilt is paralyzing, and I do think the guilt is largely misplaced. Now, maybe it would help us to feel less guilty if we recognized just some cases where we clearly want people to behave in this way. Suppose, for example, that you hear that a judge is sitting on the bench and a man is brought in, and the judge looks at him and the man says, "That's my neighbor." So, "What are you doing here?" The man says, "I'm here on a DWI charge." What would you want the judge to do? I would want the judge to disqualify himself, because I think the judge has an obligation to treat that man as a neighbor, as a person, which he cannot do in his capacity as a judge, as a participant in the impersonal order. But what would you think if the judge took the other route and said, oh, gee, Harry, how'd you get in that trouble? And he sat in that case and let him off because he's his neighbor and his friend. Well, for one thing, the judge would have committed a breach of the ethics of the impersonal society, and he would be in trouble. The judge is supposed to disqualify himself. And I think the recognition of this is a recognition of the legitimacy of the two kinds, if I can call that, of ethical rules. I face this problem frequently when I have to assign grades to students. I get to know those students pretty well, and I'm tempted to assign a grade on the basis of what I believe would really be in the best interest of this particular student. But if I do that, I may be violating some other obligations that I have to maintain the fairness and effectiveness of the system in which I'm participating. Or some other examples. If a farmer chooses his crops on the basis of a desire to do particular good for known others, he will not choose crops in the way that most benefits society. An orphanage manager. Now, that's a good thing, isn't it? It's good to manage orphanages. Now, suppose we've got a saintly manager of an orphanage. How do you want him to choose his suppliers? I want him to choose his suppliers on the basis of best quality product at the lowest price. I don't want him to say, well, Jones, you provide pretty sloppy food, but we'll let those orphans eat it because I want you to prosper because you're my friend. You should choose the oatmeal supplier that generally gives him the best quality at the lowest price. An author choosing a publisher. Do the same thing. If you really think you have a good book, you want to get your book out, and you're going to choose the publisher who gives you the best deal. Well, I'm saying two things. That, in fact, is how we do secure cooperation in some of the most important, but by no means all important, areas of our social life. That's what we do. We do pursue our own interest on the basis largely of following generally accepted rules. It works pretty good, and that's okay. But it matters a whole lot. That's what I want to get you thinking about tonight. It matters a whole lot what it is that people find it in their self-interest to pursue. And that gets these two areas coming together for us. What do people, what do Americans pursue? What are the goals of economic life? Most Americans. I title this session A Materialistic Culture? Because it is often said that Americans overwhelmingly pursue material goals or materialistic values. I don't know what that means. I really don't. And I have asked a lot of people who use, in fact, every time somebody uses that phrase, said, well, Americans are too materialistic. They're too much interested in materialistic goals. I say, what do you mean by that? And it turns out that they don't quite know themselves what they mean by that. For example, why is it materialistic? I'm not saying good or bad. I'm saying materialistic. Why is it materialistic to want a TV set if what you're going to do is watch religious programs? Or, you know, there are people who think it's materialistic to watch the regular networks, but not materialistic to watch public broadcasting. Now, I'm not saying those people are there. Maybe there is something better about watching public broadcasting. Why is it materialistic to want a deck on the back of your house, but not materialistic to want a backpack? I know people who think it, anything that you use for camping in the wilderness is not materialistic. The wilderness is materialistic. That those trees are very materialistic. It seems to me that everything has a materialistic base, and no values are materialistic. We want a lot of material things. We want hymn books, which are very material things, so that we can satisfy some values which are not materialistic. Now, I just find the word materialistic is confusing, but maybe you're able to attach a meaning to it. We can come back to that. I want to, after just casting some suspicion on the word materialistic, I want to suggest that there is one thing that most Americans do pursue pretty frequently and consistently, and that is money. My only objection is to saying that's the pursuit of something materialistic. Nowadays, heaven help us, we've gone off the gold standard a long time. Money isn't materialistic at all, it's credit. Money has gotten so spiritual that the Federal Reserve System can't control its quantity. Now, the first thing I want to say is that I think it is very useful that Americans pursue money, that Americans are, that almost all Americans are interested in more money. That's very useful in this sense, that it provides the rest of us with a way of getting people to do what we want them to do. You know, if you don't have enough people, you know, say the septic tanks have to be cleaned and nobody wants to do that. We could have a meeting and decide on the basis of ability and need and merit and all that, who ought to clean the septic tanks. Or we could be arbitrary, we could assign people to the septic tanks. Or what we could do is say, here's the wage for cleaning the septic. Nobody takes it, we raise it a little bit. And the thing is, people do respond. I think that is useful. And before you knock the interest of people in money, remember that people don't pursue money at all costs. I remember having a colleague once who I was teaching at Valparaiso University, and like so many church-related schools, the people there felt a sort of bond of fellowship and community, and we felt that whenever one of our number left, we were sort of being betrayed. We weren't sure whether he was betraying the Lord or betraying us or true liberal education, but this one fellow left, and he got a job offer from a state university that doubled his salary. And I remember somebody saying, boy, he went for twice the money. That's really money grubbing. And at first that made sense to me, and then I thought about it. And I said, no, not at all. It took double the money to get him to move. That was some indication of how committed, in fact, he was to our university. But again, I'm not interested in exonerating people's pursuit of money or in condemning people's pursuit of money. I'm saying, first of all, that it turns out to be useful that most people are interested in money because it provides us with a very simple little way to calibrate the economic system. But the most important thing to remember is that most people have read the story of King Midas, and they only want money as a means to other ends. And the question is, what are those ends? Now here comes, I don't have an answer to this question, but I think this begins to get us at a question that is extremely important for our culture, and I suspect important for each of us individually. Let me tell you what one man thought about this, because he's often been tarred with a nasty brush. It was Adam Smith, one of my heroes, who was a much wiser man than most people realize. He wrote a book on ethics before he wrote his book on economics, and they ought to be read together. But Adam Smith was the guy who argued that if people pursued their self-interest, by the way, within the rules of justice, he insisted, that the public interest would emerge. And so it was interesting to ask Adam Smith, what do you think, Adam, people find in their interest? And he answers that question very clearly. Most people, he says, people are interested in ease and present enjoyment. They're kind of lazy streak in us, and we like to have present pleasure. But he says, for most people of most classes, he was writing in the last quarter of the 18th century in England, he says, for most people of most classes, the principal aim when people are pursuing their self-interest is to better their condition. He calls it the constant and uninterrupted desire of every person, every man, he says, to better his condition. And he repeats that phrase. He says this desire to better our condition comes with us from the cradle and stays with us to the grave. But then he asks, in his theory of moral sentiments, he asks very explicitly, what are people after when they're trying to better their condition? He says, well, first thing you might notice is that most people find that the most vulgar and obvious way to better your condition is to augment your fortune, to get more money. But then, what is it that people are after? He says that's the vulgar and most obvious way. There are other ways to do it. but that's the vulgar and most obvious one. You know, be better your condition by acquiring more money, because money is a general means to all sorts of things. But what are those things? What are people really after? And Smith says what people are really after is an enhanced reputation. Very clear about that. Talks about that at great length. He's very insightful about it. People want a better reputation. Is that good or bad? Well, Adam Smith says that's bad and good. He says that can take the form of sheer vanity. He says place. That object of the wives of aldermen is probably the root of half of the strife and injustice in the history of humanity. People just want to have a better position at the table, you know, be higher up on the social ladder. But that's the worst form of it. A better form is simply the desire to be well thought of by your neighbors, to have a solid community reputation. That's not altogether a bad thing. When people, you know, even people who aren't really virtuous way down deep, if they care what their neighbors think about them, will behave in tolerably civilized ways. And isn't this one of the problems of modern industrialized urban society? That people don't have any neighbors who know them and whom they know. There is no community of peers whose opinions we're concerned about. We go to the city to escape the prying eyes of our neighbors. And many of us can't stand that freedom. Without that censor of the neighbor looking at us, without that, when we are freed from the necessity of caring what other people think about us because we've become unknown, many of us don't behave too well. But Adam Smith suggested that the desire for an enhanced reputation could take an even higher form. It was the form that took in the bosom of philosophers. And that was that we were concerned for our reputation in the eyes of the impartial spectator. The impartial spectator for Adam Smith meant God, finally. And God, who is impartial, who knows all your actions, all your motives, and is absolutely impartial in judging you. And Adam Smith believed that the highest form of ethics was to incorporate that judgment into yourself, that man in the breast, the really well-informed and sensitive conscience. Well, now, I don't want particularly to defend this view. I just want to suggest that it's not obviously base. To suggest that what makes the society work, the impersonal society work, is the desire of people to be well thought of. Recognizing that for some people, you know, that means, you know, you've seen these young kids who want to be well thought of, and so what they do is lay rubber by the stop sign. That's what they're after. What you must do is applaud. There are people who try to be well thought of by being tough and mean. Most people, most of the time, try to be well thought of by being decent. There's a litany that I like that says that thanks God for the courtesy and consideration of people in crowds. And I when I pray that litany, that means a lot to me. The ordinary decency of ordinary people, something for which I am extremely grateful. And I think that comes largely from our awareness of the fact that others are watching us, and we do want to be well thought of. Okay, what is it that most Americans pursue today? I would just suggest that Adam Smith isn't far off the track even today. In fact, when I have pushed people on what they mean by materialism, a lot of them have meant the desire to acquire goods in order to be well thought of by others. So it turns out, you see, that's the reason the backpack isn't a materialistic goal, because you want that backpack to really go off in the wilderness and commune with nature. However, if you got that backpack in order to flash it, you know, to stroll around and say, I've got an REI Gore-Tec automated transistor backpack. I think what people are recognizing here is that they're recognizing the problem, the ethical problem that begins to sneak in to this system. I would just like to offer the hypothesis that most Americans are pursuing enhanced reputation, and that that's not altogether bad. It enables us to cooperate together, provides a mechanism of cooperation, but it is dangerous. I think this is a useful but dangerous order of creation. It's useful because it does secure peaceful cooperation. It is dangerous because we deify it. We turn enhanced reputation into a god. We derive from it the meaning of our lives. We turn a means into an end. And it's here, it seems to me, that Christian ethics and Christian theology begins to have something to say to economic life. I am much disturbed by most Christian pronouncements on economic life. It seems to me that the churches, Catholic and Protestant, Christian churches, have gotten much too far into the business of pontificating, of putting pressure on the state to force people to do things that the Christian churches haven't been able to persuade their members to do. John Howard Yoder calls this yielding to the temptation of the Sadducees. He says that the Christian churches have largely resisted the temptation, have largely avoided yielding to the temptation of the Pharisees. I'm not sure that's true either. I participate in a lot of these groups in Seattle, and I don't like to judge other people's motives, and I don't know other people's motives, but sometimes there seems to me to be a perverse glee in finding, for example, that the State Department has done something stupid, because then we can feel superior, or there's a certain satisfaction in finding a racist or sexist policy somewhere, because then we can condemn it. And we Christians often think that we can be most relevant to economic life by getting together and writing statements that begin with the word, "We deplore." I don't think this is useful. I don't think anybody listens to that kind of preaching. I think the task of the church, the task of Christians, and I don't separate those two things. The church is very important for me. The idea of Christianity or Christian ethics without the church, I can't make much sense of. But I think our task is to embody in our own lives together something that is better. And now I'm ready to throw it open for discussion. Obviously, what I don't want you to do, I hope you won't do, unless you think that I'm totally mistaken again, is start talking in the third person plural about what they do. They do this and they do that. And there's a dodge. The proper way to speak is in the first person plural. But sometimes we pretend to be talking in the first person plural, and we're really talking in the first person plural. Well, I'm getting my third person. Sometimes we say we. We are guilty, we this, but we really mean everybody except us, everybody except me. Collective, talk about collective guilt performs this function. We are all guilty of sin. We have sinned, for example, and I'll give an illustration. We have sinned in Vietnam. Well, that's a dangerous notion, unless you had some responsibility for that Vietnam policy. It's particularly dangerous if you were someone who vigorously and persistently opposed the war in Vietnam. Because then I wonder in what sense you can be saying we are guilty. I fear that the person who says this is saying they are guilty and they're doubly guilty for not coming up to my high level of ethical insight. So it would be my hope that in addressing this question, we can talk about ourselves, which I haven't been doing. I've been talking about they. But I wanted to sort of set the stage, and I'll be confessional. It's a necessity arises. All right, is that controversial? Okay, I can't see you up there.
I'd like a clarification on the, but all that aside, I'm a bit confused. Are you equating the human propensity for enhancement of reputation with an order of creation?
Well, I appreciate what you said. I think that's a real danger. Mm-hmm. You find something you like, and you call it an order of creation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whoever decides those things.
Right, right. Who picks out the orders of creation? So I'll yield to that. I'll never use the concept, not deliberately, of the orders of creation in order to win an argument.
Okay.
I was using it illustratively. I thought some people here were familiar with the term, and I think that what I'm talking about is what people who have taught the language of orders of creation, which I do find a useful language, what they've been talking about. Marriage is an order of creation, and the market is an order of creation. And but it gets, I agree, it gets sticky.
But then under the
tradition, law.
On the clarifying point then is to say then that the human tendency to, or necessity almost as it seems, to work for one's enhancement of self-reputation. Are you saying that is an established and in itself is a good thing?
Yeah, I think I do believe it's a good thing. It's an ambiguous thing. I want to stress that. I think it's both useful, good, and dangerous. I guess I do think that most of us need this extra goad. In order for me to behave in the way that those people who are dependent upon me or who pay my salary have a right to expect me to behave, in order to get me to behave justly toward them, it is very helpful to them that I be attentive to my reputation. I do, in preparing my classes, think about how they will be received. I do, in talking to you, think about how I'm going to be received. I want to be well thought of. I want you to think that I'm bright, well-read, open-minded, and articulate. And what I'm saying is that's a good thing in part, but it's very dangerous because I can then be using you as means to my end. I can be exploiting you, really.
Well, and I would make the addition it's not dangerous only insofar as it might exploit or manipulate somebody else or tend to make a god of enhancement of reputation. But that in many ways, and perhaps that's the ambiguity to which you alluded, that kind of working at self-enhancement is nothing else than Genesis 3. That in fact we are trying, or at least I know it, when I work on my reputation, I'm trying to take my own life in my own hands. And I see that as kind of a revolt against God. So I make a theological indictment in many ways of that necessity.
Okay, well, I think you're posing the alternative. I think I disagree with you here. I would say it is partly a revolt against God because we are fallen, but it's not altogether that. It's partly good and partly evil. And you think that it's altogether evil?
Not necessarily. I'm just trying to again make the danger more explicit, and then one would have to push the question, and I am by no means am ready to do that. One would have to push the question, and who's going to decide what part of that's good, what part of that's evil, or we just live boldly?
Okay, that's a good question. How about somebody else? You can either respond to that or take off on a... Yes, ma'am. That's Marilyn Finn. Hi, Marilyn. I was looking for you.
What you say sounds to me very rational and logical, and it sounds...
Thanks.
Intelligent.
Well informed.
Well informed, awesome. I don't hear anything in what you said that specifically reminds me of Jesus, that reminds me of the Beatitudes, that reminds me of some things that I associate with kind of the craziness of the norms of his kingdom and the way he lived his life and the way he chose to die. And if I take his life and death being seriously normative for myself, I don't hear you saying anything that I don't think a secular humanist, I hate that phrase, but that I don't think almost any rational, law-abiding person might say. So I'd like to hear you plug into how you see this as a Christian or supported by a Christian.
Yeah. Well, let me say I agree with everything you said. And that's very well said. You're obviously well informed, Kelsey. No, seriously, she is quite correct. I think there was a little bit hinted at the end that the secular humanist would not have said. But I didn't want in my presentation to go that far. I certainly do want to go that far in this setting. And in some sense, and I do go beyond, I think I do say, I'm quite certain I say things that have something to do with Jesus. But I wanted to stop at this point, and rather than get people worrying about or trying to understand my conception of what it means to be a follower of Jesus in the 20th century, I was just trying to I'm playing secular humanist as a kind of a prelude. And I don't want to at this moment go further, because I'd like to, I'd talk too much. All right, but that's a very legitimate question and it deserves an answer privately to you, if not publicly. Okay. Oh, what I was referring to, I was quoting, I hope accurately, John Howard Yoder, who says that that the church, since World War II in particular, has fallen into the temptation, the Sadducean temptation, the temptation to try to bring in the kingdom of God, quote unquote, by getting control of the political structures and passing the right laws, or influencing the people in authority. That he doesn't think is has anything to do with Jesus. It is not a substantive norm derived from the New Testament, and I don't think so either. That's all I was saying.
And the Pharisaic.
Well, I was departing from him, so it was a throwaway. It was a judgment on people's motives, so I forget it.
What I'm trying to get at is what you feel.
Well, see,
how does that work?
Well, what I wanted to do in this session was this was a somewhat more limited task. I'm assuming that a lot of you have entertained some critical questions about your culture, American culture, and a lot of that I find focuses on the economy. I've noticed that, in fact, when people find anything, when Americans at least find something wrong with their society, they tend to hook it up somehow with the economy. So if people are, there's anxiety or, Larry, you've done it. Yeah, economic anxiety and, or what's your book title? Yeah, but Larry's written a little book in which he talks about the anxieties of Americans today, and he roots them in in the economy somehow or the other. Now, what I'm trying to get you to do is think about, well, what is it that bugs you about the economy? Well, that's the principal thing I wanted to do. You probably suspect that our economic life comes in some way under the judgment of God, or if it doesn't, it ought to. And what I want you to think about is why? What bothers you? What is it that makes you feel some kind of tension and conflict between your Christian profession and your life in the economy? I'm trying to get us to engage in a cooperative exploration here.
Can I ask a follow-up question related to that?
Sure.
I'm not altogether clear yet what your meaning of materialistic is in that question. Is our culture materialistic? Last night I had some difficulty. I thought at first capitalism was related to a market system, and market system turned out to be any macro system that wasn't dead, I mean, that had some sense of response regulating it. Tonight, it sounds to me like you define materialistic anything that is in fact material, so it's backpacks and television. Well, all cultures are equally materialistic by that notion. I mean, we're bodied, we're bodied spirits if we're spirits at all. So by definition, our culture and Japanese culture and Tanzanian culture and South African culture are equally materialistic. But when you use a quote to that question, is our culture materialistic? I don't think that's usually the meaning.
Well,
in
look,
that question,
I was trying to.
I'm
trying to throw the word out, Larry.
Yeah.
I'm really trying to throw the word out. I don't think the word is useful. I think that we use it to escape clear thought, that we use it as a kind of a nasty word. We don't know what it is we object to, and so we say it's materialism with a sneer. That's my hypothesis. And asking, is our culture materialistic, I'm really saying, forget the word. Let's get at what it really is about our culture that bothers us. That's what I'm saying about materialism. I don't find it a useful term.
Well, wouldn't materialism work like in that little statement where they say, live simply so others can live, or something like
that? I really don't think so. I think if you examine that, you'll find that materialism doesn't get at what you're after.
Well, wouldn't it mean doesn't that mean excessive materialism?
If materialism doesn't have any meaning, any agreed upon meaning, then it's hard for it to be excessive. Now, I don't know, we could spend some time. I don't think it would be the most useful way. Let me just make a proposal. Since I have trouble with the word materialism, and I find that people use it in all sorts of shifting and vague ways, would you try to tell me exactly what it is that you mean if you want to use the word? Be very clear about what it, if you think it's a word that ought to be retained, well, use a synonym for it, just for my benefit.
I don't want to particularly use a synonym for it, but I think you define what I feel I understand by materialism, and what I think a lot of people understand by materialism yourself. When you talked about the seeking to enhance one's reputation by the acquisition of goods, and the understanding that acquiring goods does indeed enhance one's reputation.
Let me just correct that. I did not say by acquiring goods. I said seeking to enhance one's reputation.
If you link that at some point,
because
we talked about.
Yeah, but the trouble is, look, when I try to enhance my reputation by giving a good lecture, that is.
Okay,
that,
well, whether you said it or not, let me say it this
okay.
way. I would think that many people might agree that materialism does relate to that kind of acquisition, consumerism type of approach to life, that by the accumulation and acquisition of additional goods, one does in fact enhance one's status or one's reputation once a relationship is made. it seems to me there may be fairly common agreement on the definition of material. I'm not really interested in saving the word, but I do not think it's a meaningless term.
Okay, Luther, I find how a lot of people use what they, when you push them, that's what they mean by it. But I would submit here that in saying materialism, we're obscuring from ourselves the nature of the phenomenon. If the phenomenon is that we're objecting to is essentially related to our desire to be superior to other people, I think it's very important that we get that into the picture. And the word materialism certainly obscures that. Okay. Somebody back there had a. I'll try to observe order, the order in which hands went up.
I'll go back to what you were saying about how this works into my Christian life. I feel like to do God's work, I need to feel comfortable with myself and my position in life and in society, and then I can take my mind off of myself and onto other people. Whereas if I don't feel comfortable, I concentrate on my own things and it's hard to relate to others. So oftentimes my prayer to God is, well, you know, if my kitchen was a little nicer, or if I could afford this, or if we could really have a bigger house, then I would feel more comfortable, or I would feel more comfortable relating to these people and doing your work, Lord. Maybe I don't say it in those words at the moment, but I think that's how it works out. And I think where I am, I struggle now, is saying, I really feel like the Lord has put me where I am to work with the people I'm working with. But I still want more. But I feel like God doesn't, it's not what I have. If I had more, I might associate with different people. Or am I making myself clear? And so I have to accept what I feel God's will is to that we make so much money a year and we live this kind of life and we have these common problems with other people and we all help ourselves in this. And that is where I feel my Christian life works in with this and some of the conflict I have.
Okay. Mark?
It's funny, the word materialistic is one that I've used actually many times. I guess I'm one of the people who probably go around saying, you're too materialistic. But I guess when I use it, I never found that anyone had trouble with it. I guess this is the first time I've ever even stopped to think about the, about the word. To me, the word is summed up just in the phrase, storing up treasure on earth, instead of storing up treasure in heaven. And the things of this earth will not last. Now, coming from Hong Kong, I come from a place that I have always called very materialistic. There's a rather insane drive to make a lot of money there. There's a lot of American corporations, European corporations. It's a quick place, I mean, it's a place to make a quick and easy buck. Labor is cheap. And I guess what I have real difficulty with, and I don't know exactly the best way to say this, Paul, but I see a real conflict because I have day-to-day associations in Hong Kong with people that make a lot of money, people who are not Christians, and I see this insane urge to make money and have things like an MG and a swimming pool in your backyard and X, Y, and Z dogs that are highly bred and horses and all sorts of things. And each time they purchase something, I have a good friend about my age in Hong Kong who's not a Christian person who's on his third MG now because he buys one and he gets kind of tired of it and he buys another one so he is happy again. And then he kind of gets bored of it and buys. And I guess what I have difficulty with is there seems to be a conflict, a basic conflict between this self-interest, self-reputation, improving one's self-reputation, and one's real concern for the fellow man. And I guess I see, and maybe this isn't true, and I would appreciate someone or you responding to this, if there isn't a basic conflict in being concerned about me or being concerned about the people that I live with and work with.
Well, I would want to say just one thing. Of course there's a conflict there. And my basic theme that runs from last night to this night is that we work on that conflict on two levels, in the public level and the private level, if you will, or in the impersonal side and the personal side. But just a quick response to this guy who wants, that's on his third MG. I know that I mean, he sounds to me to be a deeply troubled man. And I know that if I were trying to help him as a friend, I would not tell him that his problem is materialism. I don't know what it is, but I would grope for it. But it's, I just wouldn't, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't call it that. I don't know what his problem is, but it,
can I
get a gentleman back, way in the back there?
Materialistic used by someone that looks at someone else that can afford something more expensive than they can, and therefore they use the word, they're materialistic. For instance, someone buys themselves an airplane to get from one place to another, and they condemn them saying, gee, you know, who says you need an airplane? So if the person that owns the airplane said, how did you get here tonight? Did you come here by car? Yeah. Is it your car? Yes. Well, why am I materialistic but you're not?
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of, that's the sort of problem I have.
Yeah.
It's a matter of economic power, isn't it? I mean, the person that had more power in their buying power is always the one that's materialistic in the eye of the person below.
Yeah, particularly in the, I think it's important for clergymen and college professors to remember that we achieve our status in large part without having to acquire a lot of money. We get it directly. You know, here's this poor guy. He's the only way he can get status in his eyes, you know, a sick kind of status, is to go out and buy himself an MG. Me, I can get sick status directly. I got 700 captive audience students there before whom I can play Napoleon. And so, and it's easy for me to think that I'm nobler because I don't want money. Well, as I think about it, it seems to me that I can just get my goodies, my power trips, my status, without having to buy all those stupid. So college professors despise automobiles and they drive clunky Volkswagens. You know. Oh, it's almost 8 o'clock, Larry.
Well, I still want to contend that there's a meaningful sense of materialism. And I think you put your finger on it when you said that the fellow is on his third MG. You suspect that he's deeply troubled. The contention, I think, of American society being materialistic is that we express our various kinds of trouble, whether it's anxieties or not finding fulfillment that we're looking for or whatever, by a way of acquiring and using good. I mean, Margaret Mead noticed this society and some other, when she compared them, some other folks might get in the circle and try to dance their way out of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, or pray their way out of that. Americans go to the shopping center.
Right. That's
so
right.
It's a way of saying we're materialistic,
okay.
as an expression of some things which belong to a common human condition. All of us will find the short end of fulfillment. Now, how in the world do we address those elements inherent to human being?
All right,
we
but
express them by way of goods and services.
Well, some of us do. You and I largely don't, and that's and I think more and more Americans are not doing so.
I agree.
And I don't think we get at it by focusing on a peculiar symptom. I think it is a symptom. This obsession with, you know, I feel miserable. I'm going to buy a new toaster. That's a symptom, and if we got rid of that symptom, the disease would break out somewhere else, and it is breaking out in our society, in Switzerland, in wealthy societies. One of the ways it breaks out now is you get your satisfaction directly through a heightened sense experience, the drug culture. More and more wealthy Americans are finding that the MG no longer thrills, cocaine does. It's 8 o'clock, and if I've left any questions unanswered.